Hey everybody, this is Pete Worrell of Bigelow, and I want to welcome you to this episode of the Positive Enterprise Value Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Justin Donald, an entrepreneur, investor, and author of The Lifestyle Investor. Justin's built a stellar reputation, helping other successful founders and entrepreneurs move from being what he calls, quote, time-starved operators, unquote, to becoming very intentional investors who design their lives around freedom, not just financial returns. You know how I feel about entrepreneurs and freedom and intention. So this conversation with Justin isn't just about capital or cash flow. It's about something vastly deeper. It's about the invisible inflection points when an entrepreneur wakes up and says, holy smokes, there's got to be a better way to live. What does success feel like anyway? It's about the psychology of letting go, the courage to slow down, and the quiet discipline required to live life on your own terms, really to put your lifestyle first. So if you're someone who spent years building enterprise value and you're wondering what it means to build personal value, this episode is for you. Let's dive right in. Great. Well, thank you for doing this. I appreciate you.
Yeah, I'm excited to be on your show, and I had so much fun with you on mine. So yeah, this is a huge win for me just getting time with you.
Great. Hey, so that it leads into a great, maybe an opening question for you, which is, I'm not sure I understand the story of how you became into the lifestyle investor. What's the backstory for how that happened? Were you an entrepreneur? Did you grow up as an entrepreneur? Were your parents entrepreneurs?
Yeah. So, really it did start from, you know, an entrepreneurial standpoint. I mean, I've had a number of businesses over the years, and, it started young with, really kind of like selling newspaper subscriptions when I was in fourth grade, just door to door. And sure. Then I eventually built that into a crew where I would take kids out to different neighborhoods. So my senior year, I was running some pretty big crews selling coupon books and newspaper subscriptions and all kinds of things. And so, that was kind of the beginning of it. And then I got into the Cutco business and kind of built an organization under their umbrella, that ended up doing really well. And a lot of the systems and protocols and training, that I put together, they ended up using corporately as like the official training program for Cutco.
Wow.
And so as I learned some of those skills, I really figured, well, if this works in Cutco, maybe it works outside of Cutco. So I started a consulting firm, started advisory, just started teaching different entrepreneurs some of the things I learned in comp structures, recruiting, sales, retention, leadership development. And then that led to our real estate business, because I wanted to stop trading time for money. And then that led to a single family home maintenance business that really took off. And we became the preferred vendor for the largest institutional owners of single family homes.
I get it. So, who owns Cutco now, Justin?
So Jim Stitt is still the owner.
Should we try to buy it?
We should. It's a very successful business.
Yeah. I have some Cutco in my cutlery drawer now.
Yeah. Yeah. They've done very well over the years. I think their model and their structure may not, be as conducive for today's day and age on their kind of like recruiting side, the way that they do that. But corporate sales for them are very strong.
Cool. So you just mentioned a bunch of different chapters. So investor and coach, teacher, business owner, sales guy, sales trainer. You didn't mention, but I'll mention father, son, brother, husband. If you could just use a couple of nouns today to describe who you are today, what would you say?
Well, I would probably sum it up as family man first, businessman second. That's probably what I would like to be known as. It's how I like to show up. And upon, you know, my death, hopefully it's a long ways away. You know, if that were to be put on my gravestone, that would feel really good.
And so was it always in your mind to be businessman first? Sorry, family man first, businessman second?
You know, I've always wanted to show up that way for my family, but there was a group that I got involved in. One of my best friends in the world started it. It's called Front Row Dads, and it's just all about being an intentional father, being an intentional husband. And so I've been part of that group really since the beginning, so almost a decade. And I've just learned a ton from the men in that group because it's a lot of intentional people that really want to, you know, put family first.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
So, I asked you at first, but I don't think you answered me. Were your parents entrepreneurs?
Oh, my parents were not. My dad was a very successful sales guy. He did very well in appliance sales, in car sales. Those are kind of like his main two. I mean, he at one point fixed appliances as well. So like as a handyman.
Yep.
And then my mom always worked at our church as a secretary. So, oh, yeah. You know, I both of them, you know, I think were, you know, pretty low to middle income earners most of their life. My dad really, as he started to excel in car sales at one of the bigger, you know, it was a big name dealership in the Chicagoland area where I grew up. You know, he started earning some pretty good bonuses. But, you know, for the most part, you know, I learned my people skills from my mom and my work ethic from my dad. And they just kind of worked normal jobs their whole lives.
That's great. Are they still with us?
They are.
Great.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
are they still in the Chicago area?
I talked him into moving to Austin. It
took
a lot of work to get him here with us.
That's great.
And my dad, you know, both my parents retired, but my dad wanted something to do. So I hired him as kind of like an all-purpose house manager / you know, whatever needs to get done. He's super handy. He can fix anything. If he can't fix it, he can find the people to do it. So he just kind of runs our home life and helps keep things simple for us and helps out with the rentals.
Hey, is he available? You can send him up to the Northeast.
Right?
Right.
Yeah, he's good. He's in high demand. We keep him pretty busy.
I bet you do. So take us back, Justin. Thinking about the background you just mentioned, was there a particular moment or experience that nudged you out of like, my vocabulary would be like the hustle harder model of success and into what you now call lifestyle investing?
Yeah, you know, I think what – I mean, there were probably a series of moments that, you know, were pretty integral here. But what I would say is the moment that really stands out is I remember I was working in one of my first businesses and I was putting in a lot of hours. I mean, I was putting in 16, 17, 18 hour days. And it was early days. I didn't have a lot of team to help. I didn't at that point even really know how to hire people that well. You know, I was decent at it, but not great at it. I didn't really have a lot of systems in place. I wasn't very trusting to let other people do things. I felt like I had to do everything myself. And I just remember it was the weekend and I had friends reach out and they're like, hey, are you coming out? Are you joining us this evening? And it was late. You know, it was either a Friday or a Saturday night. I think it was a Friday night and I was still at the office and I knew I was going to be at the office a bit longer. I had a big day Saturday. I had a big training class. And so I remember in that moment, you know, and they're like, you never come out with us anymore. I just remember in that moment where I was very comfortable in the season that I was in. Like, this is the work ethic I need to put in to get ahead because I don't just want to be average. I want to really get ahead. But in that same breath, I remember thinking in that same moment, it was, you know, this is just a season. And I am going to build a business with better people, with better systems. And I can't have a life like this when I get married, when I have, you know, children. That this type of lifestyle is unsustainable. So why don't I max it out now? And why don't I try and figure out as quickly as I can how to remove myself from the business so that way I'm not always on the hook. It's not always me trading time for money.
Wow, man, that's awesome. Situational awareness. I mean, self-awareness, right? If you can like look at yourself, you went up to 40,000 feet there and you look down at the terrain, right? And you thought, here's where I am and here's where I want to be. And that's just fantastic. So many entrepreneurs that I meet who are terrific at what they do and they're experts, absolutely experts in their domain. But it's often challenging to take that high altitude view and realize there's a road to the destination, and you're only on one stop.
That's right.
That's cool. That's cool. So, when you made the move, as you did, you mentioned you did, from operator to investor, did you were you surprised by how you felt in the investor mode as opposed to the operator mode? And what were some of the your reflections about that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think my skill set was I was good enough to be good and get good results. And maybe even trick me into thinking I'm a really great operator. So good enough that we had great success, good enough that I knew how to do things, good enough that I wouldn't be taken advantage of if I put people into that role. Okay. But once I got out of that role and I got real people into that role, I was blown away at how much better they were than I was and how much more I enjoy doing other things than operations. So I've lived in two different worlds. I've lived in the CFO world, and I've lived in the COO world in a few different organizations, right? And in many cases, like my own organization, early days. But we had a business with a couple of friends, and I did this. And so again, like even on the financial side, I'm good enough to know how to get things done. I'm good enough to understand, you know, a cash flow statement and profit and loss and balance sheets and all that. I'm good enough to track these things, know when things are out of place. But when I hired a real deal CFO, I was blown away at how much better they were than I was. And the more I had them doing the work where they were better, the more I was enjoying not doing it. And so I just had total clarity that I don't want to operate anymore, and I don't want to be, you know, in charge of anything on the financial side, because I'm good enough to have tricked myself to thinking that I should do it. And I did it longer than I probably should. And when I got real experts in the door, things really took off. And my enjoyment in what I was building, what I was doing, really transformed. And so I'm a big picture guy. I like long-term strategy. I have ideas all the time. And so being in those other roles, it kind of stifles that part of me. But as an investor, I have the technical skill set to really be good at analyzing deals, but I actually don't love it as much as people think that I might. And I would much rather surround myself with a brilliant team that does most of the heavy lifting and lets me come in at the end to kind of look over deals that kind of pass their criteria.
Do you prefer to be in an entrepreneurial situation where you're the 100% owner, or do you like having partners?
You know, that's a wonderful question. And I think in different seasons of life, I may have answered you in completely different ways.
Ah.
So, you know, early on, I've had several businesses with several partners. You know, and at this point, you know, I probably have had or currently have around 50 different businesses that I'm, some portion of an owner in.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Most of them have, operating partners or some sort of partners, right? At this point in my life, I'm way more often a financial partner than I am an operating partner. Early on, I did more of the operations. And so I would say the right partnership, I love having partners. The wrong partnership, and it is just a train wreck, and I would rather have not had them in the first place. And so I can paint a picture of both scenarios in my life. Today, with anything that's like a passion project, I'm really careful giving out equity on those. You know, if it's lifestyle investor or tribe of investors or masterminds, foundations or young adults group, like those are organizations where I'm very careful, because these are passion projects. These are personal brands. These are, like, this to me is way more than any money that we'll ever make. You know, this to me is kind of like a legacy, you know, I guess, it is like a legacy piece. It's an impact piece, but they wouldn't be where they are without having some form of partner. So I don't have equity partners, but I have profit sharing partners. You know, I have, you know, different arrangements, different agreements with people. I want to take care of our you know, our executive team, I want them to be highly compensated. And so even though they might not own equity, they are compensated very well on the profits of the business. And so I think there's a lot of ways you can slice it. I would prefer to be in business with people I love being in business with. And I'm not afraid to be in business with friends because those have been some of the most fruitful. As long as you can set the frameworks at the beginning, those have been the most fruitful working relationships as well.
Yeah. My reflection on that is that, in my core business here at Bigelow, I've always wanted partners. I don't know why. I was reflecting on this the other day with a young lad who just joined our team, and he asked me about this. And I thought at the time, you know, I guess I could have been 100% owner. I was a couple of times of the business, and I guess I could have kept that, and I guess I could have brought on people to lead and be employees. But I always had a dream of being a band of brothers or a band of brothers and sisters where everyone was passionately engaged in trying to bring about massive positive change for entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And so for me, in this business, I always felt like I wanted a point of view that was different than mine. Yeah. So that I could recruit and retain people who had different unique abilities than I had. Now, admittedly, if people had the same unique ability as I had, that'd been a lot easier. They'd agree with me more. And people right here don't agree with me hardly ever. But it was worth it for me. But like you, and I didn't realize this until I heard you say it, I'm a owner of, you know, a couple of dozen other businesses. But in every case, in those cases, I'm an owner with an operating partner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's somebody that I really trust and love, or I just couldn't do it.
Oh, that's right. Well, and how can you scale multiple businesses if that's not the model, right? If you have any aspect of operating, there is a ceiling. And so if you want to have, you know, volume in the business game, owning multiple businesses, you really need to, you know, you got to find the right people and get them on board fast. You know, I spent a week with Richard Branson on Necker Island. And man, did I pepper him with question after question after question. But the number one thing I took away was a conversation we had. I'll never forget it. Cause that is a man who has over 500 businesses. And I'm thinking to myself, how do you do that? How do you have 500 businesses? Like I figured out how to have 50, but like, and that sound, that's a lot, right? Like I don't, you know, and so he said, the most important thing I do is I hire world-class people and I get out of the building. I get out of their way as fast as humanly possible. He said, that's it. So you've got to hire incredible people. You've got to put them in charge. You got to let them, you know, it's this whole thing that I've always said. It's like, I don't want to be a micromanager. I want to be a macro manager. If you hire high skill, high achievement, you don't have to micromanage. Right? They have a work ethic. They have a drive. They have a sophistication. They'll get it done. There's probably some coaching and guidance and guardrails along the way, but, they will take the initiative. That's what I want. I want people that are, problem solvers and initiative oriented.
Me too. And I think you get that with partnerships. That's very special. You use the word scale. And, you know, scale is used a lot today. And maybe it's even bandied about more than it should be. Sometimes it's not as helpful. Our mutual friend Ben Hardy just released his new book on scaling.
Yeah. And I have him on my podcast.
Okay. Yeah. And I love Ben. He's great. I appreciate the word and the concept, but apply it to the lifestyle investor. How do you think about scaling in your core business?
You know, this is an interesting one because early on, the goal wasn't scale. Early on, it was just to create this robust community of like-minded individuals playing the game of health, wealth, and business at a higher level than most, right? Right? Getting into an ecosystem where people can learn from and mentor to those that are in the community. And so for a long time, we had capped membership. We weren't trying to scale it. I didn't want to become another, you know, big mastermind like a Tiger 21. Which I'm a member of, but I didn't want to be huge like that. I didn't want to be 600 member or 1600 members. You know, we were capped at 100 for the longest time. But what's interesting is, you know, when I brought in our COO and a lifelong friend, in fact, he just got married. I just spoke at his wedding and We've been friends for almost 25 years, and that's who I have running Lifestyle Investors. His name's Ryan Casey. He's amazing. His big thing is, well, I get you don't want to scale, Justin, but what if I want to scale? And what if we want to scale impact? And we can do that. We don't have to scale membership. We can scale other things. And that's where we started different divisions. And so, we've got our top tier with Lifestyle Investor. We've got like a mid tier with Tribe of Investors. We've got our young adults program with Foundations. We've got a free community. We've got our alumni group. And then we've started doing a lot of work. I've been, asked to speak to a lot of the pro athletes about creating passive income and building compounding wealth and really kind of growing it, exponentially. And so, I'll be at the ESPYs this year. I was invited to attend and I'm doing a session, while we're there for a bunch of pro athletes. And so that's another division, right? Is pro athletes under the banner of Lifestyle Investor. So there's all these ways, you know, beyond just the masterminds with the book, you know, coursework. I mean, all this stuff that we've built out is really a lot of, Ryan's brainchild, right? He's thought of, you know, we've got a vetting deals course and a tax strategy masterclass, the tax advantage. We've got a mobile home park investing course. We've got, I mean, just a passive income course. So just the list is on and on.
You know, so interesting because, for over 40 years, I have resisted scaling Bigelow. And the reason is, if I'm completely candid, maybe it's a weakness of mine, but I love working in a small, passionate team. I sometimes say to people, you know how big a SEAL team is? They say, no. I say, it's six people. There's a reason for that. And so for me, that's the joy of every day is even the most junior person knows our strategy, our culture, why we exist, our shared purpose. But maybe a little bit like you, I have in the past 10 years, more in the past five, more in the past one, realized, hey, we can scale our impact by having these collaborations with other firms. Yep. So we don't have to grow headcount necessarily. We can scale our impact by doing it this other way. And actually, that's opened up a whole nother chapter for a lot of excitement and energy for our firm. So I get what you're saying. You know, when you talked about your start and the various businesses and kind of where you are now and turning over the COO, it made me think about your entrepreneur life arc. And you know, we just released our third book. It's called Intention, How the Best Entrepreneurs Unlock Life Force.
Can't wait to read it. I need to get it.
And in it, when I was releasing it, I mentioned that I think it's James Clear, the author, who said something like, the entrepreneurial journey is a journey of personal development that's merely dressed up and disguised as a business journey. It's a journey of personal development disguised as a business journey.
That's good.
So
it's really good.
The real value of the enterprise then is really who you become as you're building it along the way, right? So What's something surprising you've learned about yourself in that journey?
Gosh, I feel like there's tons of things. You know, one of them is that no matter how down and out things may be or how down and out I might feel, that there's always a way to, you know, create positive change and get the business back to where it needs to be. At least that's been my experience. So when things looked bleak, just not giving up. And I feel like, you know, I learned persistence. I learned that I was way more persistent than I thought I ever could be. I learned that the answers are often not from me, that I've got to have really smart counsel around me, very wise people that I can lean on, that peer group and mentorship really matters. But it also like accelerates and amplifies who I am, how I show up, my intellectual curiosity. If I'm around other people that I think are playing a much bigger game of life than me, growing greater wealth, building a bigger business, it just stimulates different thinking. I get new ideas. I get like, I'm the best copycat in the world, Pete. So many people think like I have all these ideas. Like I am so good at stealing from the best with pride. and then copying the heck out of it until I feel like I've mastered it and I can innovate it from there.
Does faith play an important role in your journey?
Oh, it most certainly does. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the church. And so, you know, my mom worked at the church for all the years I can remember. And so, yeah, my faith is huge. And I would also say it's like, it's that foundational, component of my life where I just don't ever give up on myself because I believe that there's, you know, I believe God's never given up on me. So for me, it's like, why would I ever give up? I just, you know, at the core of my being, I just believe that I'm going to figure out a way and I want to run a business in a way that is, I myself, our team, our, you know, employees, our staff, our customers, onlookers from the outside would really say those are our values that are very aligned.
Yeah, it's a topic that I'm intensely interested in these days because maybe it's my seniority in this business, but I see lots and lots of entrepreneurs who start out on a journey and have a pretty good understanding of levels of consciousness within them. And then over the time, they armor up. And I see this particularly with people who have, at an early stage, lots of responsibility and authority. And they kind of go together, responsibility and authority. Yep. And, you know, sometimes the humor can leave us. And sometimes the joyfulness or delight can leave us. And so I'm very, very interested in how we as entrepreneurs reawaken our understanding of our own consciousness and reach those places inside of us that we used to reach as children. And how do we do that again now?
Yeah, I love that. I think that's powerful. And by the way, I do think that there are a lot of elements of faith that do that, that can do that, that can unlock that.
Yes.
You know, where at the end of the day, it's like you, like I just always, like I am loved. I know that. And that allows me to show up in the world so much better, so much more confidently, so much more articulately, because that backbone, that foundation is just a constant for me.
Yes. So you and I work with lots of high achieving people for whom success is not a given, but they achieved some level of success a while ago. And frequently those people, in my judgment, set out to reclaim the why they became an entrepreneur in the first place, which is generally, in my view, freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question for you is, what do you say to someone who intellectually says, hey, Justin, you know, I want more freedom, but who is clinging to or married to what you know is kind of busyness, which is a word I feel is a weakness? What do you do about that?
We could do a whole podcast session on just this topic, Pete. I mean, I love this topic. You know, it's the irony in finding freedom in a business is that at a certain stage, there is no freedom, right?
Right.
In the early days or in the pre-system, pre-SOP days or in the pre-personnel days, you wear many hats, you work crazy hours, but you're doing it for yourself. And so like there's this joy, this love inside the work ethic. Mm-hmm. And so to a certain degree, as an entrepreneur that wants foundation, you know, they want freedom, like the foundation of why they're an entrepreneur is freedom. It's like, actually that in the beginning is the opposite of what you're going to get. You might eventually get there, but you condition yourself. Societally, we're conditioned to just work more, do better, make more. You know, we've got this culture that is like, go, 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 maximize, optimize. And then you're rewarded as an entrepreneur for doing those things. So you work harder, you make more money, your business grows, et cetera. So now all of a sudden you've got all these years of doing it. So it is really hard to back away from that culture or that routine that you've built. But the great irony is that that's what people want. So they're living in contradiction. They want this, but now they're conditioned to keep doing what they were doing. But an even greater irony to me is that when you do finally release that, when you do stop being so busy, you have more time to think, You have more time to strategize. You have more time to really focus on scale, to get the right people in, to build the right systems, which actually does create more freedom. It does create a much more scalable business. And so the less, so early on, work ethic was the thing I knew I could win. I knew I could outwork anyone or anyone in my circles, right? So like that's how I got ahead. But what got me to where I was the exact thing that was going to keep me from where I wanted to go. And that work ethic, though I'm glad I have it, I'm glad I can fall back on work ethic and say, hey, no matter what, if I fall on tough times, I can outwork people. But it's actually the lowest form of currency, because working smarter totally trumps working harder.
Sure.
Like developing skills and becoming an expert and surrounding yourself with other experts where you don't have expertise, that's going to far surpass that work ethic mindset. And so the level of scale, the level of freedom that you want is actually the opposite of what most people are doing. Most people become a slave to their business, to the money that they make. And that is hard to get out of. But when you build it right, you can have more scale, you can have more freedom, you can have more wealth, and you can work less.
Yeah, I think there's an additional thing I would tack on there is that, you know, from a strictly technical psychological point of view, our decline as leaders does not begin at the end of our career.
Yeah.
It begins at the pinnacle of our career.
Totally. The book Strength to Strength is all about that.
It's a phenomenal Arthur Brooks' Strength to Strength talks about this, but
so
but
good.
Brings it back to me because I see people who, you know, they've created something, they made it up. They left Bank of America because they got fired. They started off in a financial services business and they grow it to a certain degree. And actually it becomes a life sentence.
Yeah.
It's then how do you know it's time to go?
Yep.
Do you ever see people like that?
All the time.
What kind of advice
Absolutely
do you give?
All the time. Well, and to a certain degree, again, you're fighting against human nature because it's like, well, my degree was this, or I climbed the corporate ladder for this long, or I put this many hours into getting my business to where it is.
Yeah.
And it's so counterintuitive that to get to the next level, you have to do it differently. To get to the next level, you have to have think time. I mean, my life, my business, my wealth creation was transformed. Completely transformed when I just put a little thing into my calendar on Fridays called Think Time for 2 hours that was technology free. You could not reach me because all I was doing was strategically thinking.
Yep.
That was the greatest game changer. And it was hard at first. At first, I didn't know what to think about. I didn't know what to do with that time. But the more reps I had, the better I got, the more quickly I could get into flow. And I always would say, well, I'm too busy to do that early on. But it's funny because now I'm like, I'm too busy to not do that. Like, that's what creates the freedom.
Were you good at school?
I've always been pretty good at school. Even in the subjects that I didn't start out being good at, I could always figure out the system or the game. I could apply myself in a way where I didn't have to put in maximum effort, but I could get really good grades. And so early on, I kind of learned how to hack that system. So I wasn't the smartest person. I didn't retain all the knowledge, but I could take a test. I could figure out how to get A's almost across the board.
Wow. I'm envy of that. I was the opposite. I find that when I was passionately interested in a subject, I got A's. And if I wasn't, it didn't matter. So you're much smarter than I am on that. Let me ask you. So you get to a stage in your life, in your career, where you and I know that the challenge really becomes one of almost a psychological challenge more than any other kind of challenge.
Certainly.
I'm going to say maybe 90% of the challenges facing high-performing entrepreneurs are psychological. And the thing that happens is, of course, that we have this mind-body connection. And so many of us learn that actually we need to do a lot of self-care in order to take care of ourselves mentally and physically. Some people, I guess that would mean meditation. Some people it's breath work, cold plunge, workout, blah, blah. What do you do?
Well, I have a rhythm of many of those things. So I feel like for me, you know, I'm going to start my day in prayer and scripture reading. I am going to make sure that I'm getting a workout at least 5 days a week, usually at six. I like having a rest day, but I find that when I am physically fit, I'm more mentally fit, right? And I can reduce stress. I can think through problems. So like I need to do that. I've been doing a lot of hyperbaric, recently, which, you know, I don't know that I technically see that showing up, but I do think that there are healing elements where my body is healing and recovering quicker. Especially, you know, via stem cells and all that. So I love that. I'm kind of like a guinea pig on all the new health, whatever it is. I'll try it out on myself. I'm not the hugest fan of cold plunges, but when the time calls, I'll do it. I love steam rooms. I love saunas. I have a very regular cadence with those.
Yeah.
I eat very clean. You know, I think diet probably is the unsung hero. Like I actually think like when I am cheating in my diet, I do not have the same mental clarity that I have when I am really consistently sticking to a protein veggie diet. For me, that's, you know, that my body functions best on that. But I would tell you, I think most people underestimate the power of a consistent diet for physical and mental stamina and clarity.
Yeah, I agree with you. And for myself, I've always been a lark. I'm an early riser. And I know that my circadian rhythm is, you'll think this is crazy, but my circadian rhythm is really 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. I'm good. Even 8:30 p.m. to 4:30 a.m., I'm good. And if you make me do things outside of that, I'm not as good. And yeah. I just noticed yesterday, I thought to myself, isn't it interesting? And you've had this happen 100 times when you're traveling. You're going through an airport and there's nothing to eat that you
want. Oh, yeah.
Not a thing. And I scraped up some hard-boiled eggs in the bottom of a cooler counter at a restaurant. And I thought to myself, man, look at all this stuff, but it's not the fuel that I need, right?
Yep. Yeah. That's right. Well, and it's funny because of that exact situation, I'm actually going to grab my bag here real quick. So I have a travel bag that literally just is ready to go. And when I dig into my travel bag, I just have like all these like high protein type of things that I, you know, this is, if the airport doesn't have what I need,
which you got it.
Oftentimes it's not. I have tons of snacks, tons of, you know, protein chopsticks, tons of, you know, nuts and butters and all kinds of things. So, yeah, I mean, that is so crucial for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So in some of your writing, you've written about the 10 commandments of lifestyle investing. And I guess my question would be, the listeners to Positive Enterprise Value are largely high-performing entrepreneurs, but there's also some nascent entrepreneurs or want-to-be student entrepreneurs. So if they listen to you and if they could walk away with like one commandment for lifestyle investing, would there be one that has the most impact from your point of view?
It's a hard question because part of it feels like, you know, it's where you are on your journey right now.
Yeah.
You know, part of why I listed lifestyle first as the very first commandment is that, I want to make decisions on investing and business and all these things based on a lifestyle frame of mind. Does this require me to work more? Does this require me to trade more time for money? Or does this amplify my lifestyle? Does this actually create more income that I don't have to work for, or I only have to work one time for? And so that one to me, I think, is an important one for entrepreneurs, because a lot of the time it's a life of default. It's back to back to back. It's filling time wherever they can fill it versus like, how do I live a life that is, you know, it's a lot more intentional. How can I live a life by design, not by default? You know, I talk a lot about that on my podcast on the Lifestyle Investor.
Yes. Life on your own terms, right?
Yes, totally.
So in some of the investments you look at, you've looked at a ton of private deals, right? And I guess a question I would have for you is in these opportunities, maybe you, like me, think about the broad environment that the opportunity is in. You might think about the actual entry of the company itself. You might think about the entrepreneur, her or himself. What are some things you look for in a founder or an operator that maybe you now are wise about that you didn't look for as much in your earlier years?
Well, early years, I looked to see if an investment was a good investment based on the thesis, based on the market, and all of that I do think is important. But I would say more important than anything is the jockey. Who is running that investment? What is their track record? How many times over have they had huge successes? Are they brand new in this investment? Or do they have many deals that have gone full cycle? What are their values? Do I believe that they will do what's right for the investors, even if it may cost them personally? And so, like, to me, it is so much more the GP or the sponsor, the jockey of the deal, than it is the actual deal itself. Though the deal itself still matters.
Yeah, matters a lot, right? I mean, I think it was Warren Buffett way back, and I don't hear this repeated many times, but I love this quote, which he said, "What matters most is what business boat you're in, not how hard you row."
Yeah, and it's so true.
Yeah, so even a good jockey, it's hard to row in a bad business boat. But
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
So, as you think about students and young entrepreneurs who might be listening and thinking about how do I become an entrepreneur, what's some good advice you've heard given to nascent or budding entrepreneurs recently?
Yeah, I think there are a few things. You know, one of the things I would say is you've got to start somewhere. You're never going to know it. You're never going to feel like you've got it. And so, you know, in my podcast, in Lifestyle Investor Podcast, I end every episode by saying, what's one step you can take today to move towards passive income, move towards financial freedom, and what can you put into practice ASAP? And so that could go for entrepreneurship as well. Like, what's one step you can take today to become a better entrepreneur? Secondly, it's who are you hanging out with? Who is elevating your mindset, your thinking, your systems, your personal SOP for your own brain? So peer group and mentorship matter more than just about anything. That's so huge to me. And then third is what type of ongoing education are you doing? What are you consuming? People get, you know, really good at, you know, doing the workouts and eating healthy. But I think a lot of people forget like what they're feeding their intellect.
Yes.
So to me, it's like I need to be consuming information that's going to help me level up. I need to be around other people that are going to stimulate that thinking. So the peer group matters. The education I'm learning matters. The intention with which I want to learn and the intentionality around the circles I want to be in really matters. And it matters more than what I ever could have realized in the early days.
So when you look at your own relationships, and I understand exactly what you mean, if like I have, I'm sure you do, some aspirant relationships because I'd like to be lifted up in certain areas as opposed to always doing the lifting, right?
Yeah.
So as you look at that and you take inventory of your own relationships, what do you do when you find out that you've got a mix, some of it's working, some of it's not?
Well, I think that's where we need to update and revamp. You know, my wife and I do this marriage and family planning day, and we carve out a day. It's just the two of us, no electronics. We're just diving in, and I have this whole framework, and I'm happy to give this framework to your community. It has been a game changer. We've been doing it for 17 years now. It's helped us grow closer together, but part of it is intentionality with who we are going to spend time with. Who are the couples that we both want to spend time with? Who are the individuals that each of us want to spend time with? Who are the mentors that we are going to make sure are in our ecosystem? And for me, it's often picking people that are not already in my ecosystem, and I got to work hard to figure out how I can add them enough value that they will include me in their ecosystem. And that's something I've been very strategic with over the years, and it's been very fruitful.
And what about people who are in your ecosystem? Do you sometimes have to make the tough decision that you're going to proactively deselect them?
Yeah, and it's not that they're cut out completely. It's just that I'm going to minimize the frequency of contact, right? Yeah. Or minimize the frequency of getting together. There are definitely people that suck the energy out of me.
Yeah.
There are definitely people that their mindset has a tendency to drag me down, or they're more pessimistic in nature, and that's not a good energy for me to be around. I don't shine when I'm around that energy. And so I'm constantly reevaluating. And so I kind of treat it like there are really probably only 12 people in any given year that you can really dive into and have just intentional relationships with and quality time. And then I have my inner circle of three, and I'm very clear on who those people are every single year going into that year, scheduling trips, scheduling events, scheduling meetups. And then I'm always assessing, like, so who are my 12 from last year? Is it a repeat? Is it the same 12? Or is someone kind of getting bumped down and someone else is getting bumped into that 12? And almost every year, probably, dare I say every year, there's been some sort of shift in who those 12 are. I don't know that there's ever been a season in my life where the 12 remain the same. And for those of you listening that don't have 12, maybe it's 8, maybe it's 5.
Sure.
The number, like, I don't think you're going to have more than 12 really great relationships based on the time that we have to spend. So 12 is kind of my max, but you know, who am I intentionally spending time with that's going to help me level up, that's going to help me become better, smarter, faster, wiser, that's going to, you know, help pique my curiosity. But at the same time, and by the way, my 12 are generally people that help me take it to the next level. At the same time, I do think it's important that we are still mentoring people up, that we are still helping people along the way, that we can be one of the 12 to other people. Or one of the 10 or one of the 8, because there is a lot of fulfillment and impact that comes from, you know, kind of taking people under your wing. And I wouldn't be where I am if people weren't willing to do that for me. And, you know, by God, I'm going to do that for other people.
Yeah, I'm with you. I had a few, not very many, but I had a few enormously important mentors in my life. And in my business life, but also in my life. And if you know me, you know that I say work-life balance schmalance. I think it's all about work-life integration.
Yeah.
So for me, like, that's super important. But I was with a group of young entrepreneurs recently. About once a quarter, I hold a dinner. I call it a Jeffersonian dinner, where cool. Thomas Jefferson had a dinner with a theme. And so I invite 10 or so young entrepreneurs, young meaning in their 20s and 30s, and we usually have a theme. And love so it. In our last dinner, our theme was the book Die with Zero.
Yeah, and, great book.
Great book, right? Actually, a much better book than its title.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it's really about a lot more than that.
Yeah, the nuances in that are kind of the key to it, right? The title kind of doesn't do the book the justice that it is in, if you read in between the lines.
Yeah, it was a tragedy, actually. Justin, I have given that book out to probably 100 people, and a couple of people that I know got the book and said, oh, Die with Zero. I said, have you read it? They say, no, but I get it. I'm like, no, I'm sorry. That's not what the book is about. But the reason I mention it is because I thought that from my perspective at my age and at my degree of experience, a lot of the things in the book were truisms presented very well, good data, good results, and, you know, somewhat what your grandmother told you. Boy, with this group of young entrepreneurs, it was extremely controversial.
And, wow.
You know, they weren't ready to accept at all kind of the things we were doing. So just very interesting. Maybe they're new people that ought to be joining the Lifestyle Investor.
Well, we kind of have a similar tier of person, entrepreneur, high performing executive, you know, and so I love we've got a lot of diversity in age for sure. I mean, most certainly in nationality, walk of life too, but age, it is fascinating. You learn so much. Like I learned so much from these youngsters that just think about the world differently. They have different goals, different motivations, and I appreciate that perspective. Like that keeps me sharp.
I love it. Yeah, I love it. And I actually also find, just for what it's worth, that a large part of our general population and the media sort of puts down over and over younger generations. And I find it's exactly the opposite. I'm amazed by some of their insights. And I admit, many of them, you know, on average, look at things a little bit less differently than I do. But I'm really informed by that. So yeah, that helps a lot.
Well, and part of what we do, it's like it'd be easy to make decisions just based on total net worth of someone or total income on someone. But if you take a young person, and, you know, the youngest member we ever had in the Lifestyle Investor Mastermind was 24 years old. And we've had a few people in, you know, 24 to 30. And maybe their numbers weren't as impressive as some of the 40 or 50 or 60 year olds Sure. in the mastermind, right?
Sure.
But some of these guys are just on a rocket ship, and in, you know, a matter of 3 years, they've doubled or tripled or quadrupled their net worth. And so I'm always looking at, like, it doesn't have to be the end number. I want to know where you are today on your journey and then where you want to go. And that's part of our, you know, criteria and who gets in. And sometimes these youngsters are more impressive. They have such a brighter future than some of the older men and women in the mastermind.
And do you find the people in your organization, are they business owners, or are they principally post-transaction now investors?
You know, it's interesting. We probably have 70 to 75% entrepreneurs, and then, you know, 25 to 30% like high income earning professionals. Maybe they're executives, maybe they're doctors or attorneys. But then inside of that, let's just call it 75% entrepreneurs, you probably have half of them that are post-exit and half of them that are still active in their business and have not had an exit. Either they have a lifestyle business, they're not planning to exit, or they want to exit, they just want to get the business to where it needs to be in order to have the best exit that they can.
I asked because I was recently with a group of entrepreneurs. I was speaking with them, and what I realized after I dug into it a bit with them is that, and these were people who were, a vast majority were in their business, that they, many of them were counting on having a capital gain in their business someday. That was kind of part of their life plan. I don't know if they would actually be able to articulate it that way, but I saw it as part of their life plan. And what I saw was that there was not a good understanding of, given that the industry and the business that they were in, of whether they actually could achieve a capital gain or not. So just to give you an example, to be ridiculous, one fellow had a business which was very successful. I probably did 50, 60 million in revenue, made 10 million of pre-tax profit. And he made a product that he developed, and he had one customer.
Wow.
Home Depot. I had said to him, so that's a great business to own and an impossible business.
Hard to sell.
Yeah, actually impossible, right? Because there's no bank that's going to lend money on 100% customer concentration. And this was a great surprise to him. And actually, I think it probably threw him off because he was thinking, well, I haven't really been saving money along the way because I assume I'm going to have a capital gain. Do you feel like the people that are in your group have an understanding of that?
You know, I think that we have people that show up in different, like, seasons of life, different understandings of, you know, technical understanding of their business, understanding of the exit ecosystem. So I would say in some instances, yes, in some instances, no. I do find that most entrepreneurs don't save much or invest much outside their primary business, which I think is a huge red flag, and I think can be very problematic if we already know that 95% of businesses are going to fail.
Yeah.
You know, even under, what is it, 94 to 95% fail within the first 5 years.
First five years, yes.
Yeah. So we know most businesses, vast majority aren't going to make it, but most entrepreneurs put all of their wealth, all of their capital back into that business.
Yes.
And or into their lifestyle. And so we spend a lot of time educating what the wealthy do. We want to democratize what single family offices do, which are, you know, the groups that basically manage money for the billionaires. And we have this beautiful array of data that lays out exactly what it looks like. And I think most members who join, they have no concept that the wealthiest people in the world, generally have about 50 to 60%, closer to 60% these days in alternative investments. And the vast majority of that is outside their primary business.
Yes.
And so I think that is just a total like aha moment, like a total mental shift for people to realize, oh, wow, the wealthy people put enough capital in their business to make sure that their business can continue to scale. But they're really disciplined by putting money into other assets to hedge their bet just in case their business doesn't continue on the way that it continues on. And it isn't necessarily their fault if something goes wrong. I mean, sometimes it is. Sometimes it's just the economic season we're in. Sometimes it's tariffs. Sometimes it's interest rates. Sometimes it's COVID. It's luck. There's so many things. And so I just think that people that play the game of reinvesting all profits into their business and solely their business, it's a dangerous game to play, and it likely is going to end up in more of a detrimental situation than people realize.
You know, I of course agree with you. I come at it a little bit differently. While you were speaking, I was mentally calculating my own personal balance sheet. you made me feel guilty. I was kind of wonder where I am on that. And interestingly, I'm about one third, two thirds, maybe one third investment being in this core business and two thirds investment in other businesses. But I have to say it was not a mission. It was a result. But what for me, Justin, it comes from, how can I put this? I love this business. I've been in this business since July 1st, 1980. I bet you for the moments that all of the hours that I've been conscious, not 1 minute has gone by that I didn't think about this business. But I'm a whole person. So I'm not just this business. This business doesn't own me. So to me, like, I love the intellectual fun and relationship building and aspirational relationships, particularly of being able to participate and learn. And what I find is, and this is probably not a popular point of view, you know, look, for people who are in your business, my business, whatever business, when you're in the weeds, you can't see and you think your business is different from anyone else's. And when you get up to 50,000 feet, for me anyway, I see patterns of knowledge that cross over those businesses that actually make me able to bring value to them. So to me, that's all the fun.
Oh, it totally is. And I couldn't agree more. And I by the way, I love the spread of one third into your business, two thirds into other investments. I think that's super smart. And if you're doing that with a 45-year-old business with a proven track record with you know, the success you've had, I hope your audience is hearing that loud and clear, because your track record screams that you could be putting more into your business, but you're still wisely investing in other things that you can have influence on that are separate from what you're doing, that diversify and hedge against rough economic seasons, which we just went through a rough economic season for a lot of people that wanted to exit.
Yeah. So let me ask you, let's see, today's July 2nd, 2025. You and I go to sleep tonight and magically we wake up tomorrow and it's July 2nd, 2035. What's Justin going to be working on?
Well, I think for me, I get bored pretty darn easy. And so if I'm not mentally stimulated or mentally or intellectually captivated, I have to pivot to something else. And I like being a novice a lot. I like starting over, doing things that I don't know a lot about, that I can attempt to achieve mastery or at least some level of expertise in. And so, you know, the different iterations, the different divisions, the different things that we've done inside of the Lifestyle Investor Mastermind and overall, you know, business and ecosystem, this community, the greater community, it's very stimulating because we are doing more, we are reaching more people, and that is a blast. But in every other business I've had, I have gotten bored with the business. I've had to transition out of roles. I've had to put new people in. I've had to work on different projects. I've had to have side hustles. I want to stay fresh. I want to continue to learn. Now, the difference with Lifestyle Investor is this is my first passion project. This was never even supposed to be a for-profit business. When I started, I did this for free for years, right? So the goal here wasn't to have a profitable business. It was a give back arm where I could be super creative, have a lot of fun, create content, try things out. And so I think in 10 years, I am going to be very captivated, very motivated inside of the lifestyle investor ecosystem. And part of that is, like, I love the people the most. I love relationships. I love the community. I love the community events that we do. But I guarantee I will work on different projects. I will invest in different things. I will mentor certain people. I will get to know industries I don't know. I will put my own money in play and at risk based on trends I'm seeing, data that I see that allow me to learn an area that I don't know as well. When my money's involved, I tend to learn a lot better.
So what changes in lifestyle are you currently contemplating or dreaming about? What's calling to you?
Well, so one thing is we probably are going to move into some sort of pro sports division. So that's really fun. I love sports. That's a total blast to me.
What's a pro sports division? What does that mean?
So for pro athletes,
yeah,
you know, really helping them level up, but kind of creating an ecosystem just for them.
Oh, a vertical, channel within what you're doing.
That's right. Secondly, we've recently doubled down on our free community. So we have a community that, you know, for a long time, it was just paid membership, as like any opportunity, you know, we had three tiers.
Yeah.
And for a long time, it was just one tier, right? It was just Lifestyle Investor. But we've opened up this free community and started doing just, you know, education for them. And we're doing a couple of calls a month. And that group is blowing up. I mean, we're talking thousands of people now. And that didn't even exist 2 years ago.
And right? is that a feeder for your core group?
It is.
Yeah.
So that's a feeder for, you know, many different things, whether it be the courses, whether it be, you know, the different masterminds and even just collaboration. Some of the things that we're seeing inside of the young adults group, is that you've got people that don't have a lot of money necessarily, or maybe they have a lot of money relative to their peers, but not compared to the mastermind members. And so there's this ecosystem where they're teaming up, where some of these people can be sweat equity for operations inside of the businesses or key roles inside of the businesses for our paying members in our flagship community, Lifestyle Investor. So that's kind of a cool project. And, you know, Foundations just started last fall. So, I mean, that's brand new also. I mean, not even a year old. We're eight to nine months old. And that thing has taken off as well.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I've got to get my 29-year-old nephew who lives in San Diego involved with you.
Oh, it's such a great community of people. And really, it's funny. We were just going to do 18 to 29 year olds. And then we had a few people that were in their 30s. And they're like, hey, don't exclude us. You know, we might be older, but our education base in, you know, financial instruments and investing is like super novice, and we want access to Lifestyle Investor type of content, but we're not quite at that top tier yet. So that's why we push the age up to 35 and under.
So interestingly, what you've described, I don't know if you would use this vocabulary, but what you described to me is you had a number of different vehicles that you have had experience in, whether it was in these various operating companies where you were the owner, sometimes you're the CEO, COO, CFO, whatever. And then the Lifestyle Investor now has become a platform in which you can move it forward by keeping that same platform. You don't have to go to a different operating company. And
that's
just
right.
Between us, that's also how I see Bigelow. I've been so lucky to be able to have this as my professional platform, which allowed me to have a core business, but also to do the other interesting things to me intellectually, including writing and et cetera. Do you have the same energy and expectations on the personal side of your life? Like, would you have things that you're contemplating or dreaming about, living in a different part of the world, you know, learning a different language? I don't know. You make it up.
Yeah. You know, so a couple of things. One thing that I'll also include for the future, because right now I'm working on a children's book that I think will be out in September, because that's an area that I think is underserved.
And love that.
If we can teach youngsters, kids, how to think about money, how to think about investing, how to think about peer groups, I think we're going to do wonderful things for them long term. So that is one other big area that I'm pursuing. But then on the personal side, you know, part of our annual planning day, you know, that my wife and I do is we do this dreams list session. And we've got this ongoing dreams list, each of us. And you know, it started out with us making a list of 100 dreams that we have. And then we just keep adding to it and we keep checking things off. And so I'm always looking to, you know, accomplish something different. It doesn't have to be a business success. I want it to be like, I value experiences more than just about anything. Experiences over stuff. Yeah. And I love to travel. You know, we're in the process of getting our Portuguese golden visa. We've got a passport for Antigua and Barbuda. So like we definitely want to spend time elsewhere, but we love Austin. I don't know that we ever want somewhere else to be our home base because we love Austin. But I have this desire to go visit every country in the world. I'm at about 89 countries right now. I have this desire to just explore and learn, and I'm an eternal student. I just love to learn. And so the more I'm around other people, other cultures, other ways of doing things, the more it enlightens me, the more it stimulates me. So yes, on a personal side, I've got endless goals and dreams. So, you know, one of my categories most certainly is business, but most of my categories have nothing to do with business. And when I'm winning in those categories and having these experiences, it keeps me very motivated and inspired on the business front or on the wealth creation front.
Yeah, I have to tell you, the idea of doing something with younger people is so powerful. It's so attracting to me also because some of your friends and mine reach a certain level of success and then they change and they say what they want to do is give back. And, I've never really believed that. I've always felt like we need to give back all the way along. But one of the things that I am super interested in is how do you take kids who are, you know, high school, maybe younger, about college age, high school, maybe younger, and acquaint them with what you're talking about? Because gosh, if it hadn't been for a couple of mentors who grabbed me by the ear and turned me around, you know, I would have been stuck in a failing family business. And so lucky me. I'd like to pass that along.
There's no doubt about that. I mean, two things that I really believe in. We should not wait until later in life to help other people level up, to spread and help create impact. And then the same thing is true of giving. Like, I really believe we should be giving every year.
Yes.
And not just waiting till the end. And I admire the super ultra wealthy that are doing the pledge. Like, I love that. I admire Warren Buffett even more because he's been giving all along the way and not waiting until the end. And I just think those dollars in play today make such a difference. And I think that for the youngsters, part of this has to be their appetite to want to learn and grow and get better and surround themselves. But some of it is exposure. Like they don't even know that they want to do it until someone exposes them to it. So it's like, we can't just wait for the perfect person. We've got to go out and try and help mold and shape them. Now, there's the letdown that a lot of people we may try and mentor may not be the right people or it may not be the right season. And so there is disappointment in that when you can see the potential, but they're not willing to live out that potential. But at the same time, the attempt to do it, you're going to get the people that do rise to the occasion and it changes their life, changes at least their perspective and puts them on a better path. And so I do think we're called to do that, to mentor, to give, to help others learn and grow.
Yeah, I do too. And I also think that, you know, the way that you're grading yourself is you may be kind of a tough grader, that you may find that actually some of the work you do by planting the seeds and watering and fertilizing those seeds, even if they don't take root while you're watching, they could take root later.
Totally. 100%. And often that is the case.
Yeah.
Often I'll have people come back and say, you said this one thing to me and it didn't click for years and years and years. And often I don't even remember saying that one thing.
Like, yes.
It's not even like it was this defining moment for me where I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that lunch. I often have no clue. And I'm like, oh, I said that, you know, thank goodness I did.
Hey, you've been super generous with your time. I have a final question for you. In this group of listeners, yours and on Positive Enterprise Value, you know, high performance, high achievement is common, but not all of them would describe themselves as content or fulfilled. Would you describe yourself as content or fulfilled?
Yeah, I would, number one, for sure, describe myself as fulfilled. Number two, I am really working hard at being content in all situations and all seasons. Yep. And there are times where I'm much better at this than other times. I love new. I love experiences. I love doing things I've never done. So there's always this drive and desire to learn something else, to accomplish something new, to experience something new. So to a certain degree, it's like I have these loves and these desires. But also I'm also really happy and comfortable where I am. And I don't feel like, things need to change necessarily for me to live a good life. I feel like I'm living a good life. I'm very clear on my values. I'm very clear on who I want to spend time with. I'm very intentional with those peoples and with experiences, that we share and creating magic moments. But I'm always trying to work harder at contentment because, you know, without contentment, there's always the risk that where you are isn't good enough and what you have isn't good enough and you need something else to be happy. And I just don't think that that is true. I think that's a societal, you know, miscalculation.
And it goes back to what I was explaining to you earlier, which is in the book Intention, where the chapters are discovery, discomfort, dedication, synchronicity, and the most important one is awakening. So it goes back to what we were talking about, is how do you rediscover those levels of consciousness inside yourself that you had, whether it's love, beauty, joyfulness, gratitude, awe, right? How do you rediscover that?
I love that.
Yeah, it's challenging. Thank you, Justin. This has been really fun. It's so great to see you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to spend time. And, you know, if there's anyone in your ecosystem that has interest in learning more about what we do, you can go to lifestyleinvestor.com. All of our courses and masterminds are there. But if anyone kind of wants like the personalized one-on-one, we normally do these strategy sessions with people, you know, 30 minutes or 60 minutes, depending on where they are. And we normally charge about $500 for them. But for anyone in your community that is interested, I'd love to just give one away for free. So if people reach out and say, hey, heard about this on Pete, you know, on your podcast. And, yep. You know, if you go to lifestyleinvestor.com/consultation, you can get a free strategy session with someone on our team. That's open to anyone in your audience.
That's a great offer, man. Thank you for doing that for our community. We appreciate you.
Sounds good.
So my thanks go to Justin Donald for this incredibly rich, immediately useful conversation. What stood out to me was not just his investment wisdom, but really the life clarity that Justin has chosen to pursue his life. Very purposeful, with intention, and actually you heard him in service of something much larger than just self-interest. That makes sense because at Positive Enterprise Value, we're interested in more than financial returns. We're not interested in merely an outcome. We're interested in what we're going to become, the transformation that occurs when entrepreneurs realize that freedom is kind of like a skill, a practice, a daily choice. If this episode resonated with you, I invite you to share it with someone who may be standing on the edge of their own inflection point. So as always, thanks for listening. See you next time. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. We believe that entrepreneur owner managers are the most powerful pro-social and pro-economic force on the planet. And it's for that reason that we dedicate our firm, Bigelow, to working exclusively with them. At Positive Enterprise Value, we freely share our learning so that you can absorb from the experiences of other private business owners with skin in the game, just like you. Bigelow is widely regarded as the M&A advisor that deals exclusively with high-performing entrepreneur owner managers. Our scrappy independent boutique firm only offers one service, that is to help build and someday capture enterprise value. You can find all of the episodes on this podcast on Bigelow's website, which is BigelowLLC.com.